Israel presents.
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Vayera, recording and first broadcast Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 13th of November. Pardon me for saying that first. The 15th day of Cheshvan, 5769. And let me explain again why I apologized. Oh, there's an expression that a lot of people use when they use the secular date, January, February, Liminyanam, according to their way of numbering. Our way of numbering is 5769. This is not the 21st century, but it's the 58th century since creation. And we have months, and we have days of the month, and we have numbers for the days of the week. And if I say Thursday in addition to Yom Chamishi, or sometimes I say Thursday without saying Yom Chamishi, it is a fact of life that we live in a certain environment. And I think it would be nice to always say Yom Chamishi, but I haven't trained myself for that. It's something that I would be able to say only one day a week anyway. Just kidding. But I think you get the point. As far as the numbering of months, I've spoken many times that there is an additional thing that's a little, not so comfortable. That's not really the right word. Let's say problematic with using numbers for the January-February calendar for the month. I recently wrote in Torah Tidbits about Chodesh HaSheni. In Parshat Noach, it mentioned the second month. And there is a dispute whether it is Tishrei Cheshvan, that's the second month, or Nisan Iyar, that's the second month. Once we get to Yetziat Mitzrayim, to the Exodus from Egypt, we have a rule, a mitzvah of HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, which tells us to count the months, to number the months from Nisan. Noach is way before the receiving of the Torah, and perhaps Chodesh HaSheni referred to the second month from the date that the world was created, which according to one opinion was in Tishrei. I wrote there that whether the second month is Iyar or the second month is Cheshvan, it certainly is not February. And when a person writes to meaning February, he is violating the spirit of HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. Again, I say we are very much influenced by our environment. But I've said this many times, here in Israel, in the modern state of Israel, the Jewish calendar is absolutely 100% acceptable from all, in all government documentation, and anything official in Israel need not be dated November 13th, but can be dated Cheshvan 15th, Tetvav Cheshvan, which is today. I've, over the years that I'm here, 27 years, dated every single check I've ever written with the Jewish date, because you can, and it's a beautiful thing. One time I was challenged, and a guy actually pulled out a pen and added to my check the secular date. The only other challenges I've gotten were an embarrassed, is this today, when they look at the Hebrew date, wanting to make sure it's not a post-dated check. Aside from that, any document in Israel can have it, and in my opinion, therefore should have it. So let's leave this as we've done it many times and we'll continue to do it many times. And the effect that I want these words to have on someone who lives in Israel is to start using the Jewish calendar more. As far as anyone outside of Israel, you cannot date your checks according to the Jewish calendar, but you certainly can observe your birthday and those of your children and grandchildren on the Jewish calendar. In fact, do what we do in our family, observe them both. Kids know their secular date that they were born, they know the Jewish date that they were born. We even give them the birthday boy and girl status between the two, which sometimes can be up to a month apart. In any event, there are many opportunities, even not in official situations, to use dates, and it makes a statement when a Jew uses the Jewish date. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot mi-ma'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tehiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor ya Adonai mi ya'amod, ki imacha hasalicha l'ma'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya ha-omedim ebein bayam uvein bayabasha ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'meyafela la'ora u'mishibud l'gu'ula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. As you probably noticed, I tacked on a little bit to the opening of the show. I'm just having fun and playing around. We'll see what stays and what doesn't. You have the Warner Brothers opener to start things today, followed by five bongs on a little musical instrument, if you could call it that, that I picked up. I will not give it to any of my grandchildren because my daughters, their mothers, would not forgive me to having that kind of sound going around all the time in the house. So I decided to keep it for myself, and I recorded five bongs on it, so we'll see if that stays. Then you have what I've been using for a while already, the churning sound, which is the printing machine here at the Israel Center, which actually prints the pages of the Torah Tidbits hard copy, followed by the creaky door of Radio Mystery Theater, a little bit of E.G. Marshall's voice welcoming you to come in, and then the melody of Eitz Chaim Hi, which has been the theme of this Torah Tidbits audio show for quite a while now, and I am not yet inclined to change that. So that's the beginning, and now let's get into Parshat Vayera. Among the 54 weekly portions of Torah, there are 17 sedras that have none of the 613 mitzvot counted from them. Vayera has no official mitzvot on that list of Taryag, and yet there are mitzvot that are associated with Vayera, even though we could say the primary purpose of the book of Bereshit in general is for the background, the history, the story, and the development of the nation in its early period. One of the mitzvot that is associated with Vayera comes right from the beginning, where we read, Vayera Elav Hashem, and God appeared to him, meaning Avraham, Be'elonei Mamre, V'hu Yoshev Petach Ohel Kechom Hayom, and he was sitting by the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day. Rashi says, Vayera Elav, God appeared to him, Livaker Etachola. Rashi was quoting the Gemara in Bava Metzia that God came to visit the sick. Rashi is quoting our Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Oral Torah, which is explaining something here in the written word. Where do we see that God came specifically to visit the sick? not in the written word unless we stitch it together with the help of the oral tradition. First, it says, Vayera Elav, and he, God, appeared to him. Who is Elav? It is Avraham Avinu, but atypically, it does not say, Vayera Hashem El Avraham, that God appeared to Avraham. It says, Vayera Elav Hashem. And Rashi explains, and other commentaries explain, that the use of the pronoun Elav to him points us towards the antecedent of that pronoun, which is Avraham Avinu. At the very end of Parshat Lech Lecha is the episode of his circumcision at the advanced age of 99. And we learn from our sources that on the third day following Milah is the greatest pain to the recently circumcised individual. I would suggest this applies more to an adult than to a baby, but let's leave that. And because the Torah in the beginning of Vayera uses the pronoun to him, rather than mentioning his name, the commentaries say it's a follow to the previous portion, and since it does not tell us anything that God said at this appearance to Avraham, we conclude that it was not for the purpose of giving over a prophecy or a command, but rather we accept the idea that God came to Avraham to visit the sick. Is this, the beginning of Parshat Vayera, the source of the mitzvah to visit the sick? No. Is it a mitzvah from the Torah, one of the 613 mitzvot, to visit the sick? Rambam, Sefer HaChinuch, and many others say, no, not by itself. But if you're looking for the mitzvah from which we draw, among many other things, the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick, it would be the mitzvah to follow in God's ways and to cling to Him. The commentaries say, cling to God? How can you do that? God is not tangible. How could we cling to Him? The answer is, we cling to His deeds, not all of them, but the good deeds which we have lessons for. And in general, we refer to all of these acts as Gmilut Chasadim, acts of kindness. They include Bikur Cholim. Some mitzvah counters actually point to a different verse in the Torah and say, this is the command to visit the sick. Most say the command to visit the sick is either a Torah law as part of clinging to God, or a rabbinic concept that is linked to the Torah by the command to follow in His ways and by the examples that He sets in clothing the naked, as in Parshat Bereishit, in burial of the dead, as at the end of the Torah with Moshe Rabbeinu, here with visiting the sick. However you want to count the mitzvah and what origin you want to attribute to it, the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim is a significant mitzvah, is a significant act of kindness, and is subject to halacha. There is a body of halacha, just like there is in how to keep Shabbat, and how to keep kosher, and how to put on tefillin and write a mezuzah. There is a body of halacha, maybe a little more flexible on Bikur Cholim. You can buy a sefer, a book, that has the laws of Bikur Cholim. And some of the details, not only the broad concept, some of the details come from Parshat Vayera. Let me illustrate with one of my favorite examples of a detail. It's a little bit complicated. Rashi and other commentaries point out in that first verse that I read before that kechom hayom, in the heat of the day, that Avraham was sitting at the entrance to his tent, refers to an exceptionally hot day. The expression that's used is God removed the sun from its usual envelope, which dulls some of its heat, and made it exceedingly hot, so that no wayfarers would pass by Avraham's tent, and he would not have to, in this time of recuperating from his circumcision, would not follow his natural tendency to rush out to welcome guests and to tend to them, even sometimes at the expense of his own well-being. However, say our sources, God saw Avraham's distress, that nobody was about, that he was sitting at the entrance to the tent looking for people, and God decided, so to speak, that the best way to help in his recuperative process would be specifically to have him have company. And therefore, the very next verse is, Vayisa einav vayar, Avraham raised his eyes, and he saw, Vihine shlosha anashim nitzavim alav, there are three men standing there, Vayar vayoratz likratam mipetach ha'ohel, Vayishtachu arza, and Avraham ran out to greet them. Now, the way this puts together by some commentary, I say it like that because I can't open up a book and show it to you. It's something that I have written about and spoken about and feel very strongly about for many years, to the point where I don't remember the source that I got it from. But it's like this. The standard procedure that God could follow in coming to visit Avraham in his time of ailment would be to make him as comfortable as possible, and that was brought about by an exceedingly hot day, as if, just speaking anthropomorphically of God, as if God's first idea was, let me prevent people from coming to bother Avraham and let him rest. When he saw that that's not what Avraham needed and not what he wanted, he changed his tactic. And he brought guests, the angels in the form of people, so that Avraham would be able to get into things. Translate this to a situation of visiting someone in the hospital, where the natural tendency is to be over solicitous, to fluff up his pillow, to open the window, to close the window, to open the Venetian blind, to close the Venetian blind, to get him something to drink, to give him a snack, to pamper him. And that works for a lot of people. But the visitor, you and I, need to be sensitive to the needs and attitudes of the sick person. Not the visitor, but the visitee. We have to be smart enough and sharp enough to catch when a person genuinely does not want that, when fussing about him is exactly the wrong thing to do, in which case you stop fussing, in which case you don't keep offering, can I get you something, do you need anything, should I call a nurse, this and that. That's not what this particular person wants. And our task in Bikur Cholim, in visiting the sick person, is to take care of his needs, or what he perceives are his needs, and not necessarily follow the standard procedure for such situations. We need to be sensitive to it. I believe it's a lesson we got from God. No greater teacher can we have. Does the particular person appreciate when you tell him you've been mentioning his name in a Mishaberach? Or does he prefer that you not say that for him? or tell him at least. There are certain things you have to feel and be sensitive towards to better help the person in his recuperation and not make it harder for him. This includes not visiting, if that's what he wants. This includes knowing your relationship with that person. I've been reading a sefer on Bikur Cholim just to brush up on these things, but they mention there Krovim and Rechokim. Krovim are relatives and close friends. Rechokim are people who are acquaintances, and there are different guidelines for the different people because of different reactions that a person would have. And certainly, when it's a person that doesn't get along with the visitee, maybe you are going to him as a sign of goodwill, that you're willing to let bygones be bygones, and maybe he thinks you're gloating. And that's a consideration also. I will see anybody but so-and-so. You don't force yourself. And this, I believe, extends well beyond just visiting the sick. It goes to Nichum Avilim, comforting the mourner, which again is part of this whole picture of Gemilut Chasadim. In fact, a side point, I saw when there is Bikur Cholim to be done and Nichum Avilim, visiting the sick, and in a different circumstance, comforting the mourner, if the needs of the chole, the sick person, are being tended to without your being there, then it is preferred that you go Nichum Avelim, which is considered a chesed, an act of kindness, not just to the mourners, but to the deceased as well. And therefore it is given a priority. However, if it's a matter of need, the chole has first demand of our attention and time. Here's a further extension of this idea, which weighs on my mind from time to time. Somebody's birthday is coming up. Do you make him a surprise party with his friends? Do you give him a gift? Do you write him a card? Do you mention it? Do you not mention it? Most people tend to do or lean towards doing what they themselves would like. If you are the kind of person that would like a surprise party, then to be sure you're going to be one of those people that will plan a surprise party for someone else. Hold that thought. We will return in a moment, as they say in radio, or as they used to say in radio.
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
Hi, we're back. I know that sounds funny in case you didn't hear a break, but on the original broadcast on Israel National Radio, there was a break. In any event, we're talking about doing things for other people, not based on what you would like done, but on what they would like done. It's not always easy to know that, but you have to take the clues, and I think the lesson from this beginning of Vayera, with the switch from the heat of the day to the three angels in the guise of people coming to visit Avraham, was exactly the model that we could follow. It goes in a lot of directions. You want someone for guest of honor for your organization. Some people are appropriate for that. Other people are not. When a person says no, you have to see whether he's really saying no, or is he saying no, ask me again, I'd love to do it. Or is there a genuine aversion to being the center of attention that a guest of honor would be? And you have to know how to treat those situations. I just, you know, threw out some examples. There are others, but I think that's a point. The Sedra contains other examples of details of other acts of kindness. Hospitality is another one. We'll talk about that shortly. But let's have a listen to one of the Shabbat Zemirot to perhaps put us into that Shabbat preparation mode. Corey Bone. Oh,
πέσα, δίπερα αυτό δεν άφεσα. Είναι καντήσι, καντήσι, που δεν ένασα. Έβαλε με ράμε, όφεσε μαϊά, για χαμίδι, τα ρίπωνε άλλα.
I guess before we get back into Parshat Vayera, I would like to say a few words about the recent municipal elections. I refer specifically to those of Jerusalem, where Nir Barkat defeated Mayor Porush for mayor, where the city council seems to be divided among several parties, and there is this hope and vision of Barkat of more of a unity than there has been in recent past. With a Haredi candidate and a non-religious candidate, to simplify and generalize it, the national religious camp, the one known as the crocheted kippah types, was sort of in a quandary as to which way to go. Many felt that a religious person, Shomer Shabbat, has to be the favored candidate for anyone religious. And others felt that the Haredi approach is not what they wanted to see for the city, and they went with Barkat, who was an experienced entrepreneur, and people had that feeling that he would be able to run the city well. And he's not religious, but he is somewhat traditional, and people had a good feeling about him. One way or the other, the election is water under the bridge. To see what will be now is still upcoming, and we hope for the best. And that means everything for the religious nature of the city and for the city in general, as a city to its population of any persuasion. Special greetings to listeners of Torah Tidbits Audio from Cousin Martin in New Rochelle. After the visit of the three angels to Avraham, the Sedra continues with two of those angels continuing on to the city of Sodom, and with the specific tasks, one of destroying the city and its sister cities, and the other to save Lot, nephew of Avraham, and his family. While the angels are on their way, we can say, from Avraham to Sodom, there is a dialogue recorded in the Torah between God and Avraham, where God says to himself, so to speak, why should I conceal anything from Avraham, and he tells him of his plan to destroy Sodom. Avraham had no love for the cities of Sodom and the other cities in the area. His only connection was his nephew Lot lived there. He had gone to battle in last week's Sedra to save Lot, and as a result of the rest of the people of Sodom and Amorah. And God now tells Avraham of his plans to destroy those cities. Avraham argues on their behalf, not just save my nephew Lot, but perhaps you would not, he says to God, destroy good people with bad people. That would be a terrible miscarriage of justice, and the judge and seat of all justice in the world would never, God forbid, do such a thing. And we actually see in the text a bargaining session where he first asks, what if there are 50 righteous people, 5 cities, 10 per city, to perhaps save everybody? And God said, of course I would not destroy the cities. If there are indeed 50 righteous people, then Avraham pulls a bargaining tactic and says, certainly you wouldn't destroy just for a lack of 5 people. And God catches on, so to speak, and says, no, I will not destroy if I find 45. And Avraham continues for 40 and for 35, for 40, for 30, for 20, for 10. God's final statement on that is, I will not destroy the world, the cities, if I find 10 people. And Avraham stopped because he knew already that with 8 people, God was prepared to destroy the whole world in the flood and save just those 8 people, referring to Noah, his wife, their 3 children, their 3 sons, and their wives. And that's how that piece ends. But we see a very unusual and special relationship between God and Avraham Avinu, and I don't think it's meant for us to pull the same thing with God. It is meant for us to be impressed with the major initial patriarch of the Jewish people, Avraham Avinu, and see that the basis of God's relationship with all Jews throughout the centuries began with his relationship with Avraham Avinu. We don't view these things as once upon a time a long time ago. However long ago it happened, it is the story of not just our forefathers, but the story of who we are in relationship to God. I believe there's something to this idea that's embedded in the pleading before God of Moshe Rabbeinu in later times, which the Torah also tells us about, where the people deserve to be punished, even to be destroyed by God, and Moshe Rabbeinu intercedes on their behalf by saying, remember Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Now, on the simplest level, it means remember your promises to them, but I think it means much more than that. Remember that a Jew, be he a born Jew or a true, honest, sincere convert to Judaism, becomes part of the essence of who our matriarchs and patriarchs were and are, what they mean to us, and it defines a character that is particularly Jewish. This does not mean to imply that there are not Jews, we certainly know that there are throughout the generations, who don't earn almost the right to be identified as the descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and yet a Jew, by virtue of his Judaism, even when he tries to cover it up, although that's already a serious, extra serious thing, a Jew has a certain credit with God. I refer to it sometimes as the platinum card or the gold card of a of a credit card company where the average person gets a regular card and special customers get the special gold card. It comes along with tremendous responsibility. It comes along with a whole body of law that is well beyond the requirement of all human beings. I spoke about this a bit 2 weeks ago in Parshat Noach when I was trying to present the concept of the seven universal laws, the seven Noahide laws, where we, the Jewish people, say that God does not expect or even want more than those basic, decent laws from all humanity. He has extra demands of the nation which he chose to give the Torah to, the nation which made a commitment to the Torah, and it comes along with a tremendous responsibility. Just to use a crass example, but this is in honor of that same cousin from New Rochelle who sent regards. When we're talking about non-kosher, we have a code initials between us of RSP, which stands for roast suckling pig. It's an old in-family joke from many, many years ago, but it serves now to prove a point. A non-Jew who chooses to eat roast suckling pig, and so I don't have to keep saying that, I'll call it RSP, is allowed to eat it, should have no qualms about eating it, provided it's prepared properly. A Jew, a kosher Jew, a glot kosher Jew, can say to the non-Jew who is eating that food, B'tayavon, bon appetit, enjoy it. There is absolutely nothing wrong from the perspective of Judaism in non-Jews eating non-kosher. There is something very wrong from the perspective of the Jews in non-Jews doing those things which violate the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, the seven Noahide laws, plus any of the other mitzvot which we view a responsibility of all non-Jews to keep. So if a non-Jew is eating non-kosher, nothing to reproach him for. If a non-Jew is disrespectful to his parents, even though that's not one of Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, it's considered incumbent upon all peoples of the world, then there is something to reproach. And one has to know the difference in who you're dealing with as to what you reproach him for. And of course you have to reproach in a pleasant way, but that's another story altogether. In the portion of the Seder that deals with Lot and the visit from the angels there, we get to see a glimpse into the influence that an Avraham Avinu can have even on his, let's call him his wayward nephew, who left Avraham's house, went to the decadent city of Sodom to live. And yet, when it came to hospitality, he was extremely protective of his guests, even to a fault, we can say. Won't go into detail on that. And he certainly was not a lily-white character, but he was saved, so was his wife, except she looked upon the destruction of Sodom, and she was warned not to, and as a result, she turned into the well-known pillar of salt. Exactly what that means is anybody's guess. But we do see some of the lessons of Avraham even in Lot. Following the destruction of Sodom, Lot is now fleeing for his life with his two unmarried daughters, and the daughters perceive the destruction of Sodom as much more than it was, and they consider as if the whole world has been destroyed. And they take responsibility for perpetuating mankind, and the only available man to have relations with and to become pregnant from is their father Lot, and they each sleep with him and both become pregnant. The nations that come from them are Ammon and Moab, and in that there's an interesting ambivalence towards them. Ammon and Moab, the products of incestuous relationship, although they are never called for that particular origin, the daughters are not criticized in the Torah for what they did. They had the right intention, and perhaps they should have done something differently, but they're not faulted for that per se. But, ironically, it is the nations that came from them, Moab, the Moabites, and Ammon, the Ammonites, who are singled out in the Torah by a command, which we have later in the Torah, that a Moabite and an Ammonite shall not marry into the congregation of God. That has a definition where they can individuals can convert to Judaism, but there are marriage restrictions even when they become Jewish. Of course, there's a general marriage restriction on intermarriage before they become Jewish, but even when they convert, which they're allowed to do. But the restrictions against Ammon and Moab, the nation, include not offering them an option not to do battle with Israel. That's called She'elat Shalom. It's a complicated issue, which we'll get to some other time. And it is those nations that that are singled out for this level of exclusion. And on the other hand, a halachic ruling was made later in history, later from the time we're discussing now, that restricted the exclusion of Ammonites and Moabites to the males and allowed the females to marry into regular Jewish society. And case in point, which can only happen with this restrictive understanding of a Moabite shall not come into the congregation of God, allows Ruth HaMoaviah, Ruth of Naomi and Ruth fame, to marry Boaz and to become the mother of royalty, the Davidic line, starting with King David and going through Solomon and all the way through to the end of time, to the Melech HaMashiach, the future anointed Mashiach of Israel, who ultimately will come from Ruth, the Moabite, who was allowed into the congregation of God, so to speak. And that's very significant, because the despised nations turned out to be very, very significant in the whole picture of the Jewish nation. Due to the fast ticking clock, I'm going to have to leave it at that and let you carry this further on your own, but it's certainly a point to keep in mind. Towards the end of the Sedra, we have the famous episode of the binding of Isaac. I'm skipping over a lot of the Sedra. It happens to be a long one, by the way. And the binding of Isaac is seen as the ultimate test of Avraham's faith. I want to point out an interesting pair of words which we're familiar with. In the beginning of last week's Torah reading, God says to Avraham, Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetecha u'mibeit avicha. Go from your father's home and from your birthplace and come to Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Zev Lef has pointed out that one's coming on Aliyah does not end his challenge from God, it's only beginning. And towards the end of Vayera, we have another Lech Lecha, where Avraham is told to take Yitzchak, V'lech Lecha el Eretz HaMoriah, go to what later became the Temple Mount, and your spiritual journey does not end, it actually begins and intensifies when one comes to live in the land of Israel. On that note, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.